Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Healthy Gut Girl Kitty Martone, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I know I'm always excited with these guests, but this one was recommended to me from my guest Alana Slingsby, who came on our show a handful of episodes ago. She works with Moment Health, and we had a nice long chat about bioidentical hormones. And we've been keeping in touch, and she's awesome, and her business is great. You know, they offer that blood spot test that's a really affordable way to check your hormones. Anyway, she rang me up one day and suggested that I have this friend of hers on here. This woman is a medical doctor who works with Moment Health, and her name is Dr. Salome Mazgati. I hope I said that right. It's a beautiful name, and she is a beautiful woman, and so approachable, so kind. I wish that I could have come across a medical doctor like her in my life when I was so desperately in need. She is formally trained in minimally invasive gynecology. So she has been doing complex surgical emergencies and medical cases in women with endometriosis, fibroids, pelvic pain, and more. And the wonderful thing about her is that she has married her allopathic education with her alternative practices, with preventative practices, and really came up with balanced protocols to help women individually. They're customized to each individual woman and basically to what they can afford. She's incredible. I really, really like her. You guys are going to be surprised because she talks a lot about estrogen. She's definitely pro-estrogen when needed. But what she says is key, which is it must not be taken alone, and you must be guided with estrogen. It must be something that is that, you know, you're having tested on a regular basis, that you're being looked out for in terms of your personal experience and what's happening with you. And it's not something to be played with, to just take randomly. So anyway, I'm going to let her tell you all about it. Dr. Salome Mazgati.
What's happening, I feel like, is the group is getting so educated that they're coming into the group and saying, I went to see my medical doctor and they are clueless about progesterone versus progestins. They think progesterone is the, you know, is can cause cancer, and they go on and on. And the group is so smart and so savvy. And so I was excited when Alana said, we have a medical doctor that wants to chat with you, because this is, I just hope that there's a million more of you to come, because we really need people like you. Mm-hmm. So tell me, what makes you different than the average medical? I know what makes you different, because I've been looking at your stuff. Mm-hmm. What do you think separates you from the normal, regular medical doctor that I would come across as a woman?
Yeah, definitely. I got the same training as OBGYNs in residency. And I also did a fellowship in surgery, and I was going to go down the route of just being a surgeon. But what I discovered when COVID happened is that it wasn't enough. Like, I wanted to be able to help patients before and after surgery. I wanted to help patients who weren't getting surgeries. And I realized that the hormone education and the women's health education we got in residency was very emergency based. And I mean, we are fantastic at that, right? Like, I did over 800, you know, deliveries, C-sections, surgeries. Like, I mean, you can't compare that to anything else. You definitely get good at that. But when it came to the clinic aspect and preventative aspect, we didn't have a lot of continuity with patients, first of all, because we rotated through different rotations. And so we'd never got to see it through with one patient. How with one treatment that you did for them, how did it affect them? It wasn't until I left training that when I entered private practice that I got to experience that. Mm. And even back then, before I did a functional medicine training, I was always been interested in nutrition and lifestyle in addition to everything else we do. It just came naturally to me. Yeah. And I think part of it is because I am Iranian. I was born in Iran. Diet has always been a big part of, how I look at healing because, in old Persian culture, we have all these special foods. We call talk about warm foods and cold foods. When you have a cold, this is what you should be eating. It's similar to Ayurveda in India.
Oh.
I've always been interested in like natural herbal treatments and, what kind of what kind of foods can you eat when you have this or that? So and so I've been taught that by my grandmother, and so I think that's always been just in kind of engraved in me. And so
Yeah.
when I became a doctor and I had the opportunity finally to have my own patients in private practice and see it through, I just experimented with things, and then I got like more of a formal training in functional medicine. In addition, trying to understand the functional medicine tests and how things relate with each other and how they work together. And I mean, my mind is blown. So I would say I'm a regular MD, but with lots of, training and interest in all these other treatment options and alternative therapies and a functional medicine approach to things, where I try to find the root cause of what's causing this and even trying to help to reverse the disease. In regular allopathic medicine, and I'm not bashing my colleagues. I have so much respect for everyone who does go through the rigorous training we had to go through. But often it's more, as I said, emergency care. And often we try to cover things with medication or, we try to take care of things when they've already happened, but it's not preventative. And I think adding whatever knowledge I have from the formal training with whatever I'm learning now is just, for me, it's mind blowing.
Yeah, it's such a good combination. And I think it's something that is hopefully, like I said, I hope there's a million more of you to come, because I hope that that's the new vibe. I hope that's the new wave of education that's going to start to happen, because I think a lot of patients are also demanding it in a way. Like they're doing all of this research on their own, and then they're coming to their physicians and saying, I have this problem and I heard or I read, and some doctors don't like that. In fact, a lot of doctors are like, okay, you saw it on the internet. Okay, great. But some of them, and I'm seeing this a lot more than when I started my own practice and my own group and everything from 17 years ago, the amount of doctors who are willing, like yourself, who are like, oh, let's try this, or that's interesting, I'll look into that. And I hope that that's going to just be the new normal, is for people, for doctors who are really wanting to work together with the patient and and just add in other potential ideas that might be helpful, not just from their own minds, but like with the patient comes in and says, hey, I heard that, I don't know, progesterone therapy, castor packs or whatever, and be open to that stuff.
Absolutely. I do see, though, however, certain limitations in the practice of medicine just when you are in the insurance model. Doesn't matter how open-minded the doctor is. When you're in the insurance model, you have very, very limited time for a patient. And there's absolutely no way for an annual exam where I get 25 minutes with a patient, where I have to do a breast exam, pap smear, pelvic exam, maybe review some previous labs, talk about mammography, pros and cons of mammography, DEXA scan, colonoscopy, all those things that I have
and
to
their go. Questions.
And their question. And then they tell you, well, I haven't seen a doctor in 2 years, so I want to talk about vaginal dryness, sexual dysfunction. I want to talk about my hormones, my weight gain. There's no way I can address all of that in those short. And then even when I do, I'm limited with how much of the labs I can do through just the regular Quest or LabCorp. I love using functional medicine tests when indicated. So I have learned that what I want to offer to patients cannot work within an insurance-based practice. So I can really dedicate all my attention to the patients. And unfortunately, the insurances do not compensate you for anything that's related to prevention really well. So that's what I learned. Yeah.
I guess that's the downside to it, really, because that's exactly what my husband did as well, was he decided not to take insurance. He does like super billing and things like that, but because he knew that if he wanted to give proper care to his patients, that he needed more time. And that was that. Then the trade-off there is that it's expensive for the patient.
Yes,
right?
It is. So, but you gotta be, you gotta adapt to what the patient's needs are, and you gotta simplified for them. And with the testing, I try to be very reasonable. Often people go to functional medicine practices, and no matter what their concern is, they're going to get a set of tests, no matter what it is that they're complaining about. And they're going to pay upfront thousands of dollars to get all the testing. For me, it's always individualized, because I don't think that even in functional medicine, the solution is over testing or over supplementing. That's just doing what we do in allopathic medicine.
Right.
Now converting into functional medicine. I don't think that's the answer. I definitely spend a lot of time taking a history, getting to know the patients, and then eventually add tests as needed, and obviously work with the patient's budget as well. But I did want to tell you one more thing. What is another limitation is when you're in a regular practice, is that you have all these ideas of things that you want to do for patients, right? Like, let's say I trained for 2 years just surgically to learn how to treat endometriosis, fibroids, minimally invasive, like robotic surgery and all that. And then I had all these ideas. Okay, you know what? Why don't we use low-dose naltrexone for pain control? I mean, there's data that ultra low dose naltrexone decreases opioid use, right? I would bring that up to the hospital committees. They would just look at me crazy, and I would never get through. And there's all this administrative like burden and challenges you have to go through. You can never implement what you want to do, right? Or I had my attendings review my notes and say no to whatever I wanted to do outside of the scope. So there's that limitation too. Or for example, surgically, right? Staying within that. Why are we not giving every C-section patient or every hysterectomy patient high-dose vitamin C pre and post-op? We know it helps with wound healing. We have so much data, right? Try bringing this up to the hospital. It will absolutely not work. And wow. So what I'm saying is my frustrations was not only the limited time with patients, it was also that whenever I was creative, thinking outside of the box, and I had ideas what to do for patients, I wasn't allowed to do all of it. So, so I think that's another thing where, other than obviously public health policies and the whole COVID debacle for the last few years, which made me want to leave the hospital system forever, those things were frustrations I had even prior to that with the hospital system.
Wow. Yeah. Well, those are the frustrations that, you know, we as patients, I think we're having, you know, we're frustrated also because we knew we wanted to spend more time and the same things, I think, you know, it trickles down to the patient, doesn't it? Ultimately.
It does.
Yeah.
And like, imagine, have you spent that night in the hospital? Have you ever had surgery? I hope for you not. But if you had, have you seen the hospital food they serve you?
I know. Who is running?
We would do like appendectomies or hysterectomies or gallbladder surgeries. I would assist the gen surgeon. And then I go and round on them the next day, and they're being served like high fructose juices and, you know, gelatin and really greasy, disgusting food, overly salted. And you're thinking, this is a hospital. This is where people come to heal, and we're serving them the worst food ever.
Yeah.
We have them in rooms that have no window, no light. We have machines beeping all night. They don't sleep, and we wake them up every 2 hours to get some blood work. I mean, after like a C-section or a postpartum like delivery, I felt so bad for our women that had just delivered. They wouldn't get any rest, and we would bombard them with testing and medications. I felt all of this early on. I was caught in this. I need to go through this training. I need to oblige. It's like being in the military service. You can't question until you leave, and then you can do whatever you want to do. But while you're in it, you just have to serve and do as you are told. And that's really sad, because we've created this hospital system where administration gets to dictate how doctors get to work. And I don't know if you know, like ever since Obamacare, doctors aren't even allowed to own hospitals. So we don't get to run the machine the way we want to. We don't get to make the decisions, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just overall such a frustrating experience for me. I tried to apply everything I want to do now in the private practice in the functional medicine practice.
What a relief for you. What a relief.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of that, what you just described, I think came to light to a lot of the public that wasn't aware of it just simply in the last, you know, 3 years, just kind of like, oh, wow, that's really happening where doctors can't do this and are getting in trouble for even speaking up about this or that. That's just it's a shame. Yeah. It really kind of shed light on our health, on our healthcare, our sick care system. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And my mom just had a heart scare. I went home to New Mexico to go see her, and I was surprised with the food as well. I could not believe my eyes. And Another thing that was interesting was, you know, the nurse brought up probiotics to my mom. And, you know, I'm sitting there, healthy gut girl, like I have all this knowledge about gut health and stuff I've been studying for 17 years. I'm not a doctor. I'm certainly not a specialist, but I know a lot about probiotics. And I'm sitting there and she's talking about it. And I thought, she's so behind, like she's easily 10 years behind on her information. Yeah. She's, you know, pimping out like these probiotics from like Trader Joe's or Costco or something. And I'm just sitting there going, oh, but at least there's movement at there, least, right? At least. Stuff, yeah. So let's talk about, when a patient shows up to you and let's just jump right into your specialty. So mm-hmm. I personally have had multiple surgeries for ovarian cysts and polyps. And they just kept growing back. They would take them out. It was always on the right side. They mm-hmm. take them off the ovary and they take them out of my actual uterus. And then they would just grow back. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until I discovered Dr. Katarina Dalton's work and Dr. Ray Peet's work and that whole list of progesterone professionals where I was like, I'm going to try progesterone myself. And they never recommended it. What do you think is the gap there with endometriosis, growing masses, fibroids, polyps, mm-hmm. cysts? And why aren't these people immediately put on progesterone? Just take us down that road.
There's no education in the residency when it comes to natural progesterone or micronized progesterone. I even didn't learn about Prometrium until the last year of my residency. Prometrium isn't even the best version of, you know, micronized progesterone you can do. But I think because a lot of the studies that we reviewed in our journal clubs, and we definitely were all well read in what was the studies, but, you know, they were sponsored by pharma, like, you know, Orlissa, which is a company. Oh, I mentioned them now. I'm in big trouble. But, you know, they're the big, you know, endometriosis medication where it's a GnRH agonist. Instead of like Lupron, you do an oral pill and it suppresses endometriosis because it kind of suppresses your whole pituitary, hypothalamus, pituitary, ovarian axis. So you kind of create a pseudomenopause in patients. So then you have all these studies you're reviewing, and it's always with synthetic hormones. Those studies are sponsored by pharma, and these are always synthetic hormones. There's no interest in reviewing studies that come from Europe with natural progesterone, just because it's not how the whole system works. And so, with endometriosis, people are put on Lupron or oral GnRH agonists or progestin pills, like, you know, as you know, the norethindrone or the medroxyprogesterone or, you know, the IUD and all that. So mm-hmm. basically, levonorgestrel. Yeah, so you're always put on a synthetic progesterone. There's just, we never learned about the bioidentical or natural route. But if I may approach things the way I like to, is that I started early on when I was still in my fellowship training, learning about ovarian cysts and estrogen dominance. And I was like, oh, let me try, you know, vaginal or progesterone or like oral progesterone, like a micronized. And immediately, like some of the women with adenomyosis or endometrial thickening, hyperplasia, we call it, they had such a relief of their period cramps or endometriosis, you know. And I like the vaginal one for the endometriosis because it's like there was some data from Europe that it works better if it's vaginal. Mm-hmm. And then I said, oh, okay, let me not stop there. What's the data on vaginal microbiome and uterine microbiome and maybe doing some vaginal probiotics for my endometriosis patients? And I would experiment with that. This was before I even like learned more about it in functional medicine. And it's amazing. Or I would tell them, hey, let's do the elimination diet, maybe cut off dairy or gluten, which by the way, I'm not completely decided on whether that's what everyone needs to do. I will tell you a little bit more about that later.
Okay.
But yeah, so just like addressing inflammation and then talking about those things. But yeah, if you ask me where the gap comes from, we're just not being taught in residency about the natural hormones. In fact, ACOG, which is our American Society for like Obstetrics and Gynecology really poo-poos bioidentical hormones. They do say that the estradiol patch is bioidentical and Prometrium is bioidentical, and those are the only ones that are FDA approved, but they really don't believe in the compounded bioidenticals from compounding pharmacies. So even NAMS, the Menopause Society, the National American Menopause Society, poo-poos bioidenticals that are compounded. And so yeah, it's just not in the training. Where would people hear that? Every official organization or association that is not in some ways functional medicine related does not embrace bioidenticals. So where would these young doctors get that information from? Has to come from them looking outside of the box, maybe informing themselves. Me like starting to learn from people on Instagram, starting like that, and then just, investigating myself a little bit more, reading certain books, Sarah Gottfried, Laura Brighton, things like that, and then just learning through that and educating myself more. But yeah, I definitely have created certain protocols for my surgical patients where I'm like, because you brought up the probiotics before the surgery, because they're going to get antibiotics. Let's do a whole month of prebiotics, then, postbiotics afterwards. Let's help your gut healing. Let's do vitamin C. Let's do fiber intake, protein intake. Let's increase your protein because we know we need to form collagen, all of those things. And then I use obviously progesterone and I use some anti-inflammatory supplements as needed. And I really, really am a fan of testing patients and seeing what they specifically need. But if they can't afford the testing, then just trying some empiric protocols that I've developed.
My little conspiracy brain is convinced that the pharma world is kind of infiltrating the alternative natural world, because I'm seeing more in the last year, year and a half, I'm seeing more people come into the group and talk about progesterone makes endometriosis worse. It can grow fibroids. It
Interesting.
and I even saw, I should have saved or sent it to you before this. They sent a study, you might even know about it, that said that it might cause fibroids to grow,
Okay.
bioidentical progesterone.
Yeah.
Now,
Interesting. That is so interesting. I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest. I'm no longer shocked by anything. Here's how progesterone works, in my opinion. Even when in the convention, when I was at UCLA and we were doing some research, like bench research, completely like regular scientific, lab, we found out that whatever estrogen effect had on the uterus, uterine lining, uterine myometrium, it was always modulated by progesterone. So it was never like that they singularly worked alone. It was always like the one helped modulate the other. And so just to say that, how did you study that? I would like to see the study, but how did they basically eliminate all the other cofact confounding biases that would potentially have taken place? I have to say, there is not a scarcity of data. If you told me I want to find data on bananas causing hair to go light, I'm just saying something ridiculous, right? If you Google that, you will find some data to confirm that because there is such an abundance of data out there. There's a lot of low quality studies coming from one of my country where I'm born, Iran, like, India, China. There's a lot of like lack of supervision, IRB protocols. There's a lot of things. Then there's the big pharma interest. Who has sponsored the study? Was it a rat model? Was it a mouse model? How does that apply to an adult woman with a certain environment and with her own individual bioterrain? We don't know any of this. So I always take, no matter what study, with a grain of salt to begin with. But even then, I try to apply basic biochemistry and pathophysiology. And to say that progesterone alone would induce growth goes against everything we have always learned. So even when we used the lowest quality of progestin, which was medroxyprogesterone, we used that for endometrial cancer to help shrink the lining. So how does it promote growth if we are using it to shrink? And one of the very interesting doctors in New York who treats fibroids just naturally, who I think has retired now, Dr. Alan Bershovsky, he always used bioidentical progesterone to shrink fibroids and has had so much experience with that. So I have a hard time going against every anecdotal experience or anything I've
Yes.
learned so far to go with one study and use that as now as a landmark that changes everything I believe in. So I
Yeah.
think you have to look at everything with a grain of salt. I would love for you to send me the study and I would like to dissect it and maybe we can have a follow-up conversation.
Okay, I will do that. So you brought up, okay, something that happens in the group that I've had the group now for 8 years. And so it's a nice little control group of women. I don't know the control, but definitely like anecdotal, really interesting to watch people's experiences. And something that I learned about from Dr. Platt, I think Dr. Dalton and one other person mentioned this. So Ray White, who owned the progesteronetherapy.com website, it's like 85,000 pages of resources and it's just a fantastic resource. She's since passed. And whoever took it over is not doing as good a job as she did. But what I learned then and what I see now is the biggest problem with progesterone is underdosing for your needs. That doesn't mean everyone should be on mega doses of progesterone, but it seems like, and we've named it, I don't know who named it, but it's caught on and we've been using it for like 5 years now, which is called estrogen kickback. And the description is like basically you start it for the first time and you're doing like 25 milligrams, 125 milligrams of bioidentical progesterone, and everything gets worse. And so we're like, well, that's probably estrogen kickback. You might consider that you are underdosing for your needs and raise the dose until you're symptom free. And of course, that can be anything for anyone. It can mean anything. It can mean 800 for me. And I know I was hypothyroid at the time, but I didn't know it. I was at 800 milligrams of topical cream before I saw relief. Obviously, I was not absorbing that all.
No, absolutely,
So,
exactly.
okay, so to speak on estrogen kickback, is there an official name for that?
Oh, that's a great question. I wish I had an answer because I actually honestly learned about it from your group. So I never looked into literature. But when I did, that's what I love. Like I'm on Facebook on all patient groups because I need to learn from patients, right? I'm on
Nice.
the histamine group and vulvodynia group and all the groups. But yeah, I think it goes back to what I told you when we were doing bench research on uterine cancer. I think it has to do with the modulation. And as I mean, Ray Peets describes it as tissue basically releasing that estrogen and that initial like surge, right? I don't know how much I understand that, but I do understand that a lot of my patients initially do have a little bit of a worsening of their symptoms, right? And then as we adjust it implies. So I think it has to do with the modulation of both the progesterone on the estrogen receptor and the estrogen. So I think it's the interplay. Listen, nothing in the body is isolated. This is why I have a big issue with people just coming to me and saying, "Doc, I saw on Instagram I need to be taking this and this and that." And I'm like, "That doesn't work for you just because it worked for this person or that person." Because everything is an interplay. And as you know, like the thyroid is affected by estrogen and progesterone and cortisol and pregnenolone and you know that or the liver function or everything. Do you know all of those things when you decide to do one supplement or another? You don't, right? But yeah, I would say it has to do with that modulation. I definitely have seen it in practice that some women definitely need higher doses. Obviously, they also need different methods of absorption. For some women, vaginal works better. For some women, topical or oral works better. It depends on their underlying bioterrain with their gut health and liver health and how open those channels are. I'll tell you something. The studies I saw on endo, I mean, they went up to 600 milligrams for endo, so it's not unheard of that you have to increase the dose. Myself, I have had an endo patient where I went up to 400, and that's what she needed to get better. And so, and sometimes I do combination of vaginal, oral, and like topical. It's that you can take like and rub it on your uterus or rub it on your breast. Like you can use the progesterone cream topically as well. So yeah, I'm sorry if I can't completely answer that, but
No,
I
that
do
was
believe.
perfect. Yeah, I mean, you recognize it, and I think Georgie Dinkoff and also Ray Peet talking about stimulating the estrogen receptor by like waking it up almost when you start to take it. And I you might have seen me say this, but I've gotten into a real habit of saying that progesterone is the lion tamer and estrogen is the lion. And it's always like you know, you can't have one without the other, and you certainly don't want to have your estrogen. So talk to us a little bit about estrogen. I want to go back to the vaginal microbiome again in a minute, but talk to us about so estrogen. This has been, I'm really careful about recommending or suggesting estrogen, and not because I don't think it's useful. It's obviously not my area of expertise to know exactly, but I am concerned that I don't want to be the person recommending estrogen in my group. I don't want to be that person because I feel like it could, it can potentially go awry very easily. So when women have, like myself, who are about to be in menopause, and our estrogen in circulation goes down, like is almost non-existent for me. But says Georgie Dinkoff and Ray Pete, it goes into the tissues when there's no progesterone to modulate it. It'll go into the tissues and try to grow things, obviously, right? I mean, not necessarily, but it can. And so women want to take estrogen. Now, I do have some signs of low estrogen, but I'm afraid. I really am. I'm afraid because I know that all my whole life I've had issues with conjugation of estrogen at my liver. And so I am trying to bring that estrogen into balance, back into circulation by all these different ways that people recommend that may or may not work. But I'm genuinely concerned. Is my concern about taking estrogen, is that a genuine concern?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of data on benefits of estrogen, and I hope people don't hate me for saying that, but there's
no,
just
they won't.
So many studies, so many studies on that. I'm a fan of moderate estrogen levels. If I start a menopausal woman on estrogen, I don't want to bring her levels up to above 60 or 70. I don't want her to have the estrogen levels of a 25-year-old, but something that she had when she was just a few years prior, right? And that's because the most studies for like bone health, and progesterone is important for bone health as well. I absolutely recognize that. But we have a lot of study with outcome on fractures with estrogen, right? And that was when the estrogen was around, the estradiol, we always say estrogen, but estradiol, the most potent estrogen, was around 60, right? Picograms. So it's kind of, that's the level that I would like to keep patients on. That's the data we have for Alzheimer prevention, dementia prevention, bone fractures, cardiovascular health. And we also know that when in the women's health study, the biggest study on hormone replacement in women, when they were on the Premarin group alone, which was, Premarin isn't even my favorite estrogen at all. It's from horse urine. It's synthetic. They give it orally. It's super hard on the liver. It increases your blood clotting factors. Even those women had lower risk of breast cancer than higher. So it's basically didn't increase the risk of breast cancer. So I'm not scared of estrogen as long as women allow me to monitor their serum levels. Would I love to do 24-hour urine, which is the gold standard? Love it, love it. But is it practical? Not as practical. Would I love to do it? So I do serum, and then would I love to do a Dutch test maybe once or twice a year to make sure that their metabolites are not going towards the 4-OH and 60-hydroxy? Yes. And then I can tell them, listen, that in combination with your thermogram, which doesn't show increased inflammation in your breast, your mouth, and your teeth microbiome is healthy, you don't have root canals, your gut health is okay, in combination with everything, I think your breast cancer risk overall is low, and we can maintain you on that estrogen. For someone like you who might have underlying methylation issue, hydroxylation issue, maybe some was born with, like, I don't know the details, but, you know, some women have MTHFR, COMT, you know, deficiencies. They, as long as they let me monitor and as long as we do the metabolites and the serum levels, I am checking, I'm keeping everything in check, making sure they're not going towards the wrong path. We are balancing everything with the right amount of progesterone. I measure the serum progesterone levels as well. And I can tell them with certainty, I feel like you're safe. because we're doing everything we can, but we're also helping you to prevent bone fractures, dementia, you know, cardiovascular health, your sexual health, your skin, your hair, you know, your well-being. You know, when women undergo menopause, it's the fall of the decline of estrogen, which causes serotonin receptivity to go down. And when serotonin goes down, there is a lot of, you know, microvascular vasoconstriction, migraines, joint pain happens because of the collagen and connective tissue problems. And I know Rapides and Georgi Dinkov have a lot of different approaches to that, but this is just how, from all the data I've read, basically joint pain, fibromyalgia, memory issues, you know, you start developing microbiome changes in your vagina, start having UTIs more frequently, urinary urgency. That has all been fantastically remedied in my practice with estrogen. So as long as I'm keeping an eye on that, I can lower their urinary urgency, their UTI frequency, their vaginal dryness. I can help women with, you know, bone density. I can help women with, you know, a lot of women develop palpitations, AFib, and that's the decline of estrogen. A lot of women develop depression and anxiety right around menopause. It's because serotonin is stabilized through estrogen. Estrogen also is impactful in the conversion of tyrosine to dopamine and also from dopamine to DOPAC. So it kind of blocks and can increase dopamine levels. So it is important in the brain for neurotransmitters. So this has so many roles. It's such a multipotent, multivariant like hormone, and you just don't want it in excess. You don't want it in excess, and you don't want it too low. And as long as you have its best friend progesterone on board, whether a woman had hysterectomy or not, you want that progesterone on board because it's the counterpart, it's the yin and yang. I am not scared of estrogen in my practice, and I have great success with it.
That's so interesting. And I definitely struggle with it because I watch my mom, who is obviously older. She's older than me. She's in her 70s, in her late 70s, and she's been on estradiol for a long time, and she cannot get off that estradiol, or she will go, you know, it messes with her blood sugar, everything. But she also has diabetes, and she's got, you know, arthritis, really debilitating arthritis in her thumbs. And so she's got all these things. And I'm like, how can I make my way into menopause and avoid these things? And so so Georgi Dinkov, and I want to dig into this because I know that all my group's going to be like, why didn't you ask? So if the notion is that when you approach menopause, you're in perimenopause, just right where I'm at, I can literally feel, I mean, my estrogen was already low. My hormones were already low, but they're like, I could feel things changing almost overnight. And I still am worried about the estrogen. So because what Rapides says is that once it leaves your blood circulation, then it goes into the tissues. And there it is unopposed by the progesterone. There it is going to create problems that we seem to think that giving estrogen into circulation is the answer. Indeed, it may help those symptoms. But what about the estrogen that's in the tissues, the one that's creating the cystic fibrotic breasts and the one that's creating the brain fog because it's unopposed in my brain now and it's just in circulation? Am I making any sense there?
Absolutely. But what is their solution then to all this estrogen deficiency in the circulation, the symptoms that women develop? What's their just increasing progesterone? Because I'm not sure if I've had success in menopausal women with that alone. I have had women who think like in the group and they don't want to use. I actually had a patient whom I met before I knew about your group who was a Rapides fan. And she said, I just want to lower my estradiol and I just want to do progesterone. We had the hardest time, as much as we increased her progesterone, to get these symptoms under control that she developed new when she underwent the menopause. So my question is, what's their approach to that? What's the solution? Because my role here is to make women feel better. right? And as long as I'm doing their firmograms and ultrasounds and their fibrocystic breast is not getting worse. In fact, it's getting better because I'm approaching the progesterone and the iodine and all that. I'm doing all of that and the inflammation in the body the right way. Or I'm checking, other markers, their CRP and the homocysteine and all that. And I see like there's no sign of estrogen toxicity because a lot of the symptoms that were associated with estrogen dominance are no longer there. And should I still be worried? That is my question as a practitioner, because I'm here to help women in whatever way I can. What is their practical approach to that? Because I work with these women every day and they want help, right? They are feeling miserable. And the progesterone alone in menopausal women hasn't always been an answer for me. And it's my first go-to because I start women on progesterone before they even hit menopause, right? So when the estrogen declines and you can measure it in the serum and it's below like 30, that's when they have the biggest issues. And so I can increase progesterone, but I only get so far with controlling those symptoms for them, right? So as I'm saying, I'm trying to hit the middle ground. I am controlling for inflammation. I'm checking their breast health. I'm doing all this. I check the uterine lining. Like, where could I go wrong? I'm not making their fibroids grow. I'm not making their lining grow. I'm not making their breast inflammation worse. So is estrogen that bad in that circumstance? If you're addressing everything, if you're aware of everything, I think it's all context. I think we have to become more less black and white and understand that if everything, it's the bioterrain of the person. You can give the healthiest woman just the best whatever supplement it's or sorry, the unhealthiest woman the best supplement, it's not going to do anything. But if you make the woman overall healthier, she doesn't need to be scared of anything. That's where I like to take patients to. Nothing should scare you. And we can work together. I'm happy to work with you, Kitty. But I mean, my goal is to take that fear of anything away from patients. And that's where I get my excitement from. Just like really in the day-to-day helping women. Because I could just sit at home and research and read things in theory, but in practice, I have found a lot of limitations with that kind of approach.
So I with the testing prolactin, because I was trying to figure out, well, how do I know? I would love to know what the estrogen levels in my tissues are, you know? And so a few people were saying, well, the prolactin levels can give you a kind of an idea if you have high prolactin that, you know, we're having issues with estrogen, even though my estrogen might be really low. So that'll be an interesting test to do as well. I also have this, and I know I just did this thing with this genetics guy who really blew my mind in terms of, like you're saying, it's so individual. It has to be in context when we have this conversation with someone, which is also why I try to stay very general in the group because I don't want to be like, oh, we're doing that for each individual person here. So I, you know, he blew my mind about it. Like I do have two variations of the MTHFR. And I have the inability to break down adrenaline properly, and I have the inability to chelate metals properly because I don't make metallothionein as well as the next person, all these things, right? And so I loved hearing all that because it made a lot of sense. And what was I going to say? The estrogen. So yeah, that's the thing that I haven't learned from that work yet either is like, okay, yes, taking aspirin, yes, taking different things that will promote, you know, supporting thyroid function, all of this stuff, but it still doesn't change the fact that my levels are unremarkable. Like it's crazy. And so one of the things about the Dutch is when I take the Dutch, I have, you know, and it even says on there, it's like these levels are too low. We can't really rely on this test.
I've seen
Yeah, that's me.
that
Hi. But it does say that my 1600H is really, really high.
The pie is still thicker in the 16, even though I've seen that for patients before.
I'm like, okay, well, if this is unreliable, I'm not going to pay attention to it. But it does beg the question, like, am I still sending estrogen through the liver in that in favoring the 1600H? In that case, DIM wouldn't work for me though, would it? Because
And
it
I don't like using DIM in anyone above 40 anyways. There's other ways to help with the bringing it towards the, there's so much. There's like, even green tea extract, bioflavonoids, and then you can do like myoamine and with the combination of calcium glucuronate if you have done a gut test and you know what the beta glucuronate is. But yeah, DIM is kind of not the right approach because it also lowers overall estrogen levels so hard, and women fluctuate so much in their 40s. I don't know if you've seen the graph. So in the 20s and 30s, your estrogen is kind of like really just high, and in the 40s, it goes like this, bounces up and down. So what if you give the DIM in the wrong cycle, and then they could crash them, and then you just don't catch it in the right way. So yeah,
I'm
it's not
so
my
glad you
favorite.
said that because a
Yeah,
lot
it's.
of women just really just fall back on DIM a lot. So yeah.
Yeah, that's another thing where I'm like, please, please, if you're doing everything you think you're doing right, but you're not feeling better, seek out the right doctor because, there's just a limitation on how much you can help yourself. It's just like me watching tax strategy seminars and I'm still not understanding taxes. I have an accountant because there is a lot of information. We live in a really wonderful world with the World Wide Web, but it doesn't mean you understand how it applies to you, right? And
Right.
there's a lot of intricacies that you might not know. Yeah, so I think coming back to you, it does seem that you have a tendency because of these enzymatic mutations that even like the little estrogen that there is, whatever it is converted to, like from your aromatase, from fat tissue, whatever, it's like whatever little is there is, there is just the more the disposition towards the abnormal metabolites that can totally be addressed, right? Like helping your methylation and helping. And this is where I love doing a Nutrival, checking all your B vitamins, or doing an organic acid testing. I like to know what your bioterrain is with your heavy metal toxicity, your mineral deficiencies, your vitamin deficiencies. I didn't even talk about that. But it's the basics of making sure your body is even working on a mitochondrial level in the right way so that your hormones can work the right way and your liver detoxes. And then you want to make sure your detox pathways are open, you're pooping, you're peeing, you're sweating, and your lymphatics are flowing. But even someone with that, we have managed to bring them towards the 2OH pathway. So it just, there is ways to do it. I don't want you to be scared of, I don't want any woman to be scared of anything. You and we can do anything unless, as long as we understand the context of our body. Right. And I think it's wonderful we have the SNPs and the genetic testing, but I like to work with functional markers foremost because you might have those genetic mutations, but it might not translate into a functional deficiency of anything. And I test you, and you might not even have that mutation and you still have deficiency. So I like to work with the functional
Right.
markers.
Yeah. It's nice to get the full picture and to have that in context of the individual
Yes.
person for sure. Yeah. Well,
Absolutely.
that's really, really okay. So, that's good to hear. I like hearing that, not to be afraid of things. That's definitely something that is a pervasive vibe in the group is, women are afraid of cancer and they're afraid of, these masses that are growing and they're afraid of their bodies changing so drastically. So let's talk about surgery. So a lot of women come in the group and say, I left my doctor because I don't want surgery. And I always try to say this, which is, sometimes they have to come out. Sometimes they have to come out, but you want to be able to have the right people supporting you in what you're learning, like a second opinions and stuff like that. But it's true though, right? I mean, sometimes these masses, especially fibroids, they need to come out, and that's just a fact.
Yeah, these are benign, smooth muscles, and they grow, definitely are definitely stimulated by growth of estrogen. Did you know that other things can make fibroids grow as well, like hypothyroidism, obesity, where they have inflammatory markers? And there's obviously genetic factors. We have more fibroids in Hispanic and Black women. Insulin, right? Like pro-inflammation and insulin resistance can make fibroids grow. Did you know that mold can make fibroids grow? Because mold, first of all, depending on what type of mold, can be an estrogen mimic. That can cause like that molecular mimicry. It can bind estrogen receptors, and it also incites metallomatrix proteinases, which create more collagen formation, so it makes fibroids grow as well. So there's so many underlying issues. If someone comes to me and they have any type of estrogen excess and some disease related to that, like heavy bleeding, adenomyosis, endometriosis, fibroids, polyps, what I would ideally like to do for all of these women is heavy metal testing, right? Because lead, cadmium, their estrogen mimics. I would like to do mold testing. I would like to do all their mineral deficiency, like mineral testing, vitamin testing, because we know that vitamin E and vitamin A can reduce fibroids, can make help them shrink. Vitamin D can help them shrink. Again, insulin, I like to check insulin levels. So if someone wants me to do all of that and they're willing to do the work and work with me and change the diet and lifestyle and go to bed at the time I tell them they should go and stop the blue light and their EMF exposure, yes, we can help them in a non-surgical way. But have I done fibroid surgeries on women who had 40, 30, 40 fibroids where the uterus literally was just a whole, yeah, it was just a mess? Yes, we have. And so what I'm saying is there's always a scale. Come earlier if you're trying to do things naturally. Don't wait until the fibroid is 15 centimeters in size. I have removed those, or four, until you, like, don't wait until you have 30 fibroids, right? So there is always there's a timing for things, but we can definitely try things naturally. Now, for endometriosis, I have to say it's such a severe disease, and it's almost like worse to cancer to me, and surgically very difficult for us surgeons. And you only should go to a surgeon who cuts it out, who doesn't fulgurate or burn this endometriosis, because much higher risk of recurrence and pain. But with endometriosis, I've had it where I've tried everything, diet and lifestyle changes, and the women still had worsening pain. We tried progesterone and it still was painful. There's a point where you have to do surgery. And so it's a discussion to be held with the patient. This is where you develop a relationship where they trust you. And it's only after, with time, where you can make that decision together. But with, you know, I'm going to tell you, and you might not believe me, but I'm one of those surgeons where people have to beg me for surgery. Like they have to know this is really what they want, because I'm cutting into their body. They're going to lose part of their organs, and they have to understand what the implications for that are. And it's very risky. So I want them to know fully what their options are.
What, tell us what endometriosis is for people who don't exactly know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, we describe it as implants of endometrial-like tissue outside of the uterus. So every month when you get a period, you're shedding your endometrial lining, right? The superficial lining, there's different layers to that. There's a layer you don't shed, but the superficial layer you shed. And the implants, the theory was that women have retrograde menstruation. And so this lining kind of squirts into the abdominal cavity, and they grow that. Endometriosis, however, we now know is mostly genetic and has to do with certain HLA subtypes. And there is definitely a genetic disposition. And we know now that even in prepubescent women, before estrogen is peaking, you can find endometriotic implants, right? And so it's basically a disease where you have implants outside of your uterus that act like your endometrial lining whenever you get your period. So when you're getting your period, there's the signaling of your inflammatory markers, your cytokines, to basically constrict the vessels and shed the lining. Well, those implants react to those inflammatory markers and cause a ton of pain and ton of inflammation. So it causes scarring. It can you know, present itself on the ovary, inside the ovary, inside the fallopian tubes. It can be between the rectum and the vagina. It can be in the bladder. It can be on your diaphragm. We have found endometriosis in the chest, in the thoracic cavity, in the brain, in the eye. I mean, endometriosis, this is why it can't be retrograde menstruation alone, because how did it get up there, right? So there is an immune defect, right? The immune system wasn't able to suppress implants that most likely people are born with. And then there's all this xenoestrogens and this heavy metal burden and the toxic burden and all the plastics and all these industrial chemicals that we are bombarded with. So now you have something that maybe your grandma was exposed to, basically your mom inherited, and you in utero got from your mom, and then you're born with it, and then you are exposed to all of those toxins as well. And then estrogen comes in and it gets worse, and then you're estrogen dominant, possibly worst case scenario, and then things get worse. But you can have endometriosis without even being like in the serum having super high estrogen levels. It
Really?
really depends on different phenotypes. That's why I think it's definitely a lot immune system related and inflammation related. And we're going to get to a point where we're going to develop, immune system modulators where we can address this as well, other than just surgery. But as of now, the gold standard is surgical excision, because that has been having the best improvement of patients' pain levels. So my advice would be, your periods shouldn't be debilitating. They can be painful, but if your scale from 0 to 10 pain level should be not above 7. You shouldn't be lying in a corner crying, miss work, miss school, miss college, not be able to even have a conversation, eat food, and you're basically out of, you're not functional. That is not normal. You also shouldn't be have to go to the emergency room with nausea and vomiting from your period. You shouldn't have to have such heavy periods that you are basically just hemorrhaging. So all those things. And then not everyone presents just with painful periods. A good subset of endometriosis patients, 23%, just present with infertility. So if you're a woman who is young and who hasn't been able to get pregnant over a year, definitely also something to a discussion to be held. It's really hard to diagnose it in ultrasound. It really is diagnosed laparoscopically best, because you have to really look at the structures. But yeah, I would say if you have infertility, if you have heavy periods or very painful periods, and then a few other signs would be pain with intercourse, pain with urination, pain with bowel movements. I'm sorry, I talk so much.
No, I love it. It's so good.
I'm sorry. And then, another sign would be like brown spotting, like the color of your bleeding, brown spotting before and after your period. And yeah, so it's a very complex disease and very difficult to treat. I think it makes fibroids for me look easy,
Oh,
So,
wow.
yeah.
Wow, that's so sad because it's so common. It's more common now, I think, than ever. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think
Yeah.
because first, maybe we are more aware of it and we diagnose it better. And also because we have a higher toxic burden than ever.
That's really, I'll go back to the estrogen topic and mix this together with what you just said. It really seems like my fear of estrogen comes down to the fact that I am winging all of this on my own. So, we just decided that I have these issues with methylation and with detoxification. So, if I were to self-medicate with estrogen, I'm going to take that estrogen, whether I apply it topically, vaginally, or I take it internally. I'm going to send that through my liver as it should. And when it gets to the second phase of detox, it's going to go down, or first phase of detox, it's going to go down the 16-OH pathway. So I'm going to do bad things with that estrogen. So I need to be able to see somebody like yourself who can bring balance so that when I do take on the estrogen, it's not going down that pathway. So estrogen can be, and you kind of said this already, it really is about context and balance. And what was going to tie in with what you just said about endometriosis and our toxic burden, that's it, is that, we have such a toxic burden now compared to our parents and our parents' parents. And that's being really overlooked, isn't it? I mean, I think the xenoestrogen component to hormone imbalance, I think, is probably the most underlooked at thing, don't you think?
Yeah. And did you know that there was a study where they checked like umbilical cord blood, and babies are born with like over 150 toxins already? Like, you can't win. Like, this is what you're born with. This is what intergenerationally has been, given to you before you're even born. So yeah,
Wow.
it's really hard. This is why I love working with women who want to get pregnant too, because oh my God, I can help them clean up so much. Ideally, we want to do that before they get pregnant. But yeah, so there's so much to say. I 100% agree with the xenoestrogens. It's like all the laundry detergent and the perfumes and the dry sheets, right? And the plastics. And I tell everyone, don't drink sodas from aluminium cans, or don't drink from your plastic bottles. Filter your water, filter your air, make sure that you use clean products for cosmetic personal hygiene. Let me test your heavy metals. I can't emphasize how much those heavy metals can be estrogen mimicking. Let me check if I have some concern for mold. Let me check for mold. Let me, do those things. But you're absolutely right. They're often overlooked, and people jump right to the supplements, and the underlying cause is still not addressed, right? People think, oh no, I'm naturopathic now. I'm doing things naturally. And you still haven't addressed what's causing all these imbalances in your body.
I like what you said about the other things that can cause endometriosis, or was it fibro? Well, really, probably both
Fibroids,
driving it, is that because the mold, the xenoestrogens, you said hypothyroid imbalance, because that ultimately is what it's not, it's triggering the estrogen to then make them grow, because it's the estrogen that's mitogenic, right? It's the estrogen that causes the cells to differentiate and divide and grow, right? So the mold, it's not the mold so much as it is the mold acting like estrogen or acting like a xenoestrogen. Is that right?
But different pathways too. As I said, it can work through like collagen stimulation directly, and they're so complicated. They're these mold toxins. I mean, they do so many different things, but definitely part of it is through estrogen, 100%. Another example, I did say vitamin D deficiency. Both endometriosis and fibroids have been shown, but then people get this super high dose. That's a little tidbit I want to share because a lot of people don't know this, but like they give this high dose vitamin D supplements, right? Like 10,000, 50,000 units. Oh my goodness, the taxation it puts on your kidney to convert it into the active form. And then it's like depletes your magnesium and vitamin A and vitamin D share the same receptor. So now you're becoming vitamin A deficient because you're blocking that. And that causes thyroid issues, which then causes worsening. So yes, vitamin D is important, but in what context and what levels? People just hear vitamin D and then they put themselves on vitamin D supplements. No, I measure your storage and circulating form. I tell you how to do it in a way where you don't have to activate it so much, so it doesn't put so much taxation on your kidneys or deplete your magnesium. Let's use a vitamin D lamp. Go into the sunlight. How about natural things, So I'm just saying, even though the things I mentioned are important, still it's not as easy as, oh, go and take vitamin D or, zinc can help your immune system. So now, oh my goodness, I've seen women with zinc levels at 140 and copper imbalance because now they tank their copper. The zinc is super high because with the FLSC program, Dr. Crory's protocol for COVID, everybody heard you have to be on zinc to prevent COVID. They overdose their zinc, or, I know, or I have seen people be on liver supplements daily and then their copper was off the chart. So what I'm
Oops.
saying is anything I say still needs to be monitored and tested before someone decides to take those supplements. Just because studies showed that this and that works doesn't mean that applies to you on an individual level. And we can do it easily with like a hair tissue mineral analysis, but if you can afford it, the queen of tests for me is the Nutrival. And we can do more. We can do so much more. We can do gut health testing. We can do, mold testing, heavy metal testing. So there's so much we can do.
What is the Nutrival?
Oh my God, it's the best test ever. I'm so in love with it. It's so difficult. And a lot of people don't know how to read it. So that's why nobody does it. It's like a combination of organic acid testing and your like fatty acid, like beta oxidation. Like it shows on a cellular level what your mitochondria is doing. It also shows like some of your heavy metals. And yeah, so basically it shows you your B vitamins, amino acid absorption, fatty acid composition, and minerals and heavy metals. It's like the tests for me, but it's so complicated. I did it for myself. You have to pee, you have to get the blood drawn, and it has to be spin for plasma and the whole blood because they know for certain minerals you want plasma, for others you want the RBC, you want the whole blood. So they kind of have divided it into that. And not everybody wants to go through the hurdles, but if someone wanted to, I get a lot of information from the Nutrival. But if they don't want to, I'll do a hair tissue mineral analysis. It's a great start, better than nothing. And ideally, I would love to do everything like serum and urine and hair tissue. Like you want to have as many data points as possible.
Yeah. Wow, that would be exciting. That I got excited. I've been in this business too long because I'm like, ooh, I want to do that test. Like I want to do all the tests.
I know. I'm with you.
Yeah, and then I had done my 23andMe a while back, and this guy, this genetics guy, this molecular pharmacologist, had him on my show last just the last show that I had. And he took my data and he put it through this self-decode platform. And then from that, he created this like protocol. And he said that, you know, he takes like your top 5 to 10 variants and he bases it on that. But he's like, even those variants have variants. Like there's even more to the data than that. So it is just endless with the gene, with the genetic stuff.
Yes.
But one of the things he said to me was that I have every possible variant that hinders my making, absorbing, breaking down vitamin D. So he's like, even that,
Like receptor SNPs where you can't even like you can take as much as you want, it's never going to increase your levels. And it shouldn't be the goal either. Like, you know, like if for some people who have those problems, like if you supplement and supplement and you're not increasing even the circulating levels, try different ways of, you know, maybe they are lacking certain co-nutrients or they have the SNPs, and so you're not going to get them to a certain level. And there are some people that don't even believe that we should be vitamin D supplementing, but
Yeah, I was in that camp for a while because I was a big fan of, I'm a big fan of Morley Robbins, and
I think he's amazing.
he's the sweetest. He's an
Yes.
angel. And I was really in that camp for a while, but I couldn't, and now I feel a little bit bad because I should call him and tell him that the cod liver oil was not budging my D. It was not like every time I went in for blood labs, and this is over the course of 5, 6 years, my
Well,
levels
I would
were
try the vitamin D lamp. That's tricky because you have to activate it the same way. I would try that because then it's not the hydrox, like you don't have to hydroxylate it. I would try that. I would see if that works. I mean, if even if you're in the sun in California, like your vitamin D never increases.
Yeah, and I think, it doesn't help that I'm so olive skinned. I think that just hinders it as well. But it makes sense because that's why I am in the career that I'm in, is because I struggled so much with immunity and my health my whole life and couldn't understand when by the time I, started doing natural and allopathic, alternative forms of healing and balance, my gut health was a huge player and it helped a lot, but still, battling viral things and things that just would not get better and I could never figure it out. But it certainly helps. It's just insight, like you said, data points. More data points helps that for
With
sure.
someone like you, I would say optimize everything else that helps the immune system support, like make sure all the nutrients are perfect if you can't get your vitamin D up, because that's not just the only thing that's going to be part of your immune system. And I always think of the body as a miracle worker. And like, what was the evolutionary interest in creating those SNPs in you? Like, what were your ancestors trying to protect you guys from? Like, and that would be interesting to find out, because there was definitely also a purpose for that, right? We know that there was always a purpose, like even with sickle cell anemia, it was to protect people from malaria. There's always an underlying cause. What could it have been for your ancestors? So I wouldn't necessarily say that's bad. I would just help the body work around it, make sure your functional markers are optimal, you are on top of your inflammatory markers, you know what your body is doing, and you can compensate for things. I don't know if you knew, but like with MTHFR, the highest rate of MTHFR mutations is among Mexicans and Italians, but in a functional way, in a functional and like in the studies, functionally, it's such a little problem for them because they have such a high folate diet, high vitamin B rich diet, that it never really translated into issues for them. So what I'm saying is, yes, you're giving certain genes. So what? I am brunette, I'll never be blonde, whatever. But I can work around things and make the most out of my potential and help my body fulfill its potential. That's why I'm saying your genetic SNPs should not cause you to be scared of going ahead with certain treatments that your body needs, as long as we are monitoring and guiding you the right way.
That's really well said. Beautiful. Well, tell us, can you tell us how to reach you? I'll put it all in the show notes, but I also are you're working with Moment?
Yes, I work for Moment. I do consultations there and I love it because, you know, it's a great team and they have a really good progesterone product that I tried. But a lot of patients tell me other progesterones didn't work. This one is wonderful, has no red dye, has no chemical fillers. It's from, you know, yams and great product. I work with
And it's
Moment
a
Health.
3% or what percent? It's a 3%.
Yeah, they have like different,
Oh, so
they
you
have different,
compound them
yeah, we
as
compound it
needed. Okay.
depending as what the patients need. And then I have my own practice too, where I apply more like the principles of balance protocol, which was my mentor, where I really take into account the environment, you know, EMFs, air, water, sound. And then I'm not just focused on hormones in that practice. It's just generally making people better. And then I also work part-time in an IV clinic where we do Lyme and mold patients. So I just have so many, I wear so many. But I think people definitely can contact us through Moment Health. And then I would love for people to follow me on Instagram. I'm really trying to increase my following because I would like to write a book soon. And I would love for people to be up to date with things that I'm working on.
Oh,
So
good. Well, I'll
yeah.
certainly do my best to contribute to
Thank
getting you some new followers and
you.
exposing all of your good works in our group. And
Yeah.
yeah, if you ever just want to, well, you'll get bombarded if you pop in there to say hi. You'll definitely get bombarded. But yeah, this is very useful and really the information that I think everybody needs to hear, especially coming from you know, medical doctor who knows all about this stuff. And it's really inspiring and gives people hope, you know, that there's someone like you. I think that's part of the problem in the past has been, and now is just, okay, I need to see a functional doctor to get help. But then you go to see a functional doctor and then it's a lot of the same, you know? And so I think you're unique. And I think that, it's exciting that that you're available and out there to help people, and that like I said, I hope there's a lot more of you coming.
Yeah, I hope so too. May I add one last word,
Of
Kitty, about this?
course.
I feel like we have become a very polarized society with every aspect, right? And we're not very tolerant of maybe different views or different, you know. It was so obvious when it came to COVID and when people chose different routes of how they wanted to go about their health and her health autonomy. What I would love for us in this field is to really come together and support each other instead of bashing people. I hear a lot of MD bashing on social media, and it makes me sad because not every doctor that is a medical doctor thinks the same way, and not everybody, and even the medical doctors that don't think like me, they're not coming at it from a bad place. They really aren't working with what they were taught, right? So everybody has a different consciousness level and has to reach those different energy and consciousness levels on their own. And that's not my place. But I don't bash anybody from a different, you know, category. I actually love working with chiropractors, naturopaths, acupuncturists, hypnotherapists, trauma tissue coaches, you know, personal trainers. So I hope that we all can activate our heart chakra and come together and not, you know, bash each other, but actually support each other more. Yeah.
That's so well said, because I think it's really needed, and especially in a group like mine, where, I started that group because I was helpless. You know, all of my experiences with medical doctors were all, I was worse. So, and a lot of
Exactly.
women in the group are coming from that perspective. So there's a lot of trauma and
Yeah.
anger about
Yeah.
that. And so you're right, it needs to be healed, and we do need to come
Exactly.
together. And
Yeah.
you're just the person to do
Yeah. I hope
it.
so. That's what I try to like. My whole life, I've been bridging between cultures, between different, you know, all these different countries I've lived in. And so this is now my role to bridge people and tell them not every medical doctor is going to traumatize you. I'm on your side. I want to help you. I want all these years of conventional training to just make me better, not worse for you, you know? So, yeah.
Fantastic. How lovely is she? Like, I don't know. My husband's going to kill me because I'm just like hiring every single practitioner that I interview lately. they're all so good lately. Really, really. I mean, we've had a lot of good people over the years, but, I've always managed really well on my own and with a lot of the guests' informational input. But lately, as mentioned, everyone in the world knows that I'm going through menopause. And, it's nice to have some input. It's nice to have people like this woman, like Dr. Mascati, who is just, oh my gosh, I really love her. So I've already sent her before, right after our episode when we did this, I sent so many people to her because there are so many complex cases in the group. I think a lot of women come to the group when they're at the end of their ropes. You know, they're just, they've tried everything and they're just like, where do I go from here? And I think that this doctor is brilliant. She really knows how to cover all the bases. And I don't, you know, look, I have never stood on a soapbox about my, about what I know and what I share. I've taken great caution with estrogen and I will continue to do so just because I know and have seen the ill effects and I've read a tremendous amount of data and studies that suggest that estrogen does a lot more nefarious things in the body than we're than the conventional narrative is really telling us or revealing to us or, you know, so I don't know. I'm still going to use a lot of caution. You know, we'll see. I will share with you. I am super transparent about what the things that I'm trying. And she definitely had some good points that made me feel like, you know, if I cannot resolve some of these little issues that I'm having right now through Kitty Bloomfield's program of 16-week course of, you know, working out, tracking my food, tracking my macros, doing things that I've never tried before, then I might look into the estrogen thing. I might. We'll see what happens and I will completely be honest with y'all about it. And then, you know, again, if you're taking it, I support you. You know, as long as you're getting good guidance and you know what's happening with your body in every possible way and you're thriving, you know. But otherwise, I'm going to continue to just say buyer beware. Be very, very cautious when using estrogen and definitely work with Dr. Mascati or try to find somebody similar because she is the bomb and you can reach her. All her information is in the show notes and please do her a big, huge favor and follow her on all social media outlets. That information is also in the show notes.